Kripke is a neuroendocrinologist and he's a climatologist currently at Stanford University. In his research, he has examined hormones, specifically those that underlie stress, brains, and the environment, and the interaction among these things for better understanding our behavior. His professional career began when he became a member of a baboon troop when he was 21. And to get a sense of the type of questions he asks and the way that he is able to engage us as an audience, I want to read a very brief excerpt from a primate's memoir. I decided that, in addition to my lab work on neurons, I wanted to study the optimistic side of it. How come some of us are more resistant to stress than others? Why are some bodies and some psyches better at coping? Does it have something to do with your rank in society? If you have lots of relatives, if you hang out with friends, if you play with kids, if you sulk when you're upset about something, or if you find someone else to take it out on? I decided to study this in wild baboons. They were perfect for it. Baboons live in big, complex social groups. And the population I meant to study lived like kings. Great ecosystem of Serengeti, grass, trees, and animals forever. Marlon Perkins country. Since his time as a self-described low-ranking member of the baboon troop, Dr. Sapolsky has published extensively in both the scientific and the popular literature. This includes 5 books that document his adventures in scientific inquiry, in the field, in the lab, and his exciting and sometimes very scary interactions with primates, both humans and baboons. He is a recipient of many scientific honors, book awards, teaching awards, and grants, including the prestigious MacArthur Foundation grant, otherwise known as the Genius Grant. Dr. Sapolsky has been described very often. He's been described as one of the leading neuroscientists in the world, and as one of the best science writers of our time. I'm confident that if you've read any of his work, that you agree. This is pretty remarkable. It is rare to encounter such an individual that's engaging in rigorous research, in interesting research, and important research, and to present it in a way that all audiences become engaged in the results, their implications, and his sense of humor. He's very funny. His books are quite difficult to put down. I was talking to some students last night, and I learned that not only are his books assigned in psychology classes, biology classes, anthropology classes, but here at Santa Clara University, in English classes. He's inspiring all of us in the professional community and many of our students here at Santa Clara. Tonight, Dr. Sapolsky is presenting on the biology of our individuality and how we might begin to make sense of our behavior, given an understanding of the interactions among genes, hormones, and our environment. We're in for a great hour and a half. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Sapolsky.
Nice welcome. I see my mother did you on the phone before. Let's see, starting off, as was just mentioned, I kind of divide my life between two worlds. One, I'm a neurobiologist and I live in a lab with a bunch of rats and neurons and worry about things like that. And then also for part of my time over the last 30 years, I hang out with primates out in a national park in East Africa. And I think sort of this dual life of straddling being a neurobiologist and a primatologist and all of that, I think maybe has given me a chance to have some sort of a different perspective on humans. So what I'm going to talk about here is essentially asking, are we just another primate species? And are we just a bunch of neurons glued together? Where do we fit within the realm of other animals and within the realm of the building blocks, the neurons, the brain cells that make us who we are? So I'm going to start off in a very unprofessional way, which is by complaining about somebody else's lecture. And this was a conference I was at a few years ago, Brain and Behavior or some such thing, and it was all about humans. And up got this guy, and I don't know quite how he got himself invited, but he was a flawed geneticist. And he got up and he basically said, actually, he literally said, well, if you guys are going to want to understand human behavior, all of you are going to have to become flying neurobiologists within a decade. And here's the argument he made. He shows that, okay, roughly the same number of genes in flies and in humans. And when you look at the nuts and bolts, when you look at the nervous system, we humans have not invented new types of neurons. We have not invented new types of brain chemicals, neurotransmitters. You take a fly neuron, you take a human neuron, and put them under a microscope, and they look exactly the same. The same types of neurons, the same types of chemical messengers, the same enzymes, the same this and that. And his conclusion there was, so if you want to understand humans, this is the place to start. And I sat there and I thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. What this guy just proved was, if you want to understand humans, it's not going to be in the genes, and it's not going to be in the neurotransmitters, and he's just showed us all the realms that don't define who we are. Now, in making sense of us, what winds up being a challenge at times is even how to frame where we fit into the world of other organisms. And some of the time, the challenge is recognizing the ways in which we are just like everybody out there. Some of the time, it's dealing with the fact that aspects of us are exactly the same as every other species, but we use those aspects in utterly unique ways. And then some of the time, the challenge is dealing with things we do that simply have no precedent elsewhere in the world. Okay, let me give you an example in the first category, ways in which we're just like all the other beasties. Okay, you are a hamster. And you're a female hamster. And as a female hamster, what you do is you ovulate every 4 days. This is what female hamsters do. So you're a female hamster, and you're ovulating every 4 days, unless the graduate student devoting his life to what you do has taken another female hamster and put it into the cage with you. And what happens over the next few weeks is the two of you begin to lengthen your cycles and eventually synchronize them so that every 8.5 days, within 20 minutes of each other, you ovulate at the same time. You synchronize your cycles. Unless they then take a male hamster and put him into the cage, and they desynchronize their cycles, and they start cycling at different lengths and different times. And it works this way. And amazingly, it works with odors, with pheromones. And you can show this, not very high-tech stuff, like you hold the hamster's nose and she doesn't synchronize her cycles anymore, or you can be really elegant, which is you don't put the male in the cage, you put him in a different room with enclosed cages, and you pump the air from his cage into this one, and he desynchronizes their cycles. It's all done with odors. And what's the coolest thing about it is, when you put the females together, it's not random who synchronizes the other first. It's the socially dominant female who does it first. So this is totally cool, and you find this in dogs and cats and various other species. Apparently, you can go to a 7-Eleven in Iowa, and you can buy a can of, like, pig ovulatory pheromone spray thing that you can go and spray in your pigs to get them all to ovulate at the same time. I have no idea. We didn't synchronize our pigs' ovulatory cycle. But this is that well understood. You can do this. And the most remarkable thing is it works exactly the same in us, where it's known as the Wellesley effect. Named after Wellesley College, where in 1970, described by a researcher there, Martha McClintock, showing during freshman year, roommates over the course of the year begin to lengthen and synchronize their cycles, except for women who had close intimate relationships with gonadally intact males, who synchronize their cycles, and it's all done with olfaction. Women who had olfactory deficits, you don't get the Wellesley effect gland. Interestingly, that was the Wellesley class from which Hillary Clinton graduated. What you have been seeing is it's all a factor, and the most amazing thing is, again, it's not random who synchronizes who. And what the study shows is women who are more extroverted, socially dominant, synchronize the other women. This is so well known that, like, in college, at dinner, people would brag about how, you know, when I roomed with her this summer, I had her synchronized by August 1st. So in some ways there, the challenge is recognizing nothing special about us at all. Second category, realms in which we look just like everybody else until we look closer. Let me give you an example. Okay, this human ritual. There's these two humans sitting opposite each other at a table, and they're absolutely silent. They're perfectly still. They make no eye contact. Nothing is happening more physically taxing than every few minutes one of them lifts an arm and moves a little piece of wood around on the table. And if these were the right humans in the middle of a chess grandmaster tournament, their physiology is identical to a male baboon that has just ripped open the stomach of his worst rival. Chess grandmasters during tournaments go through 7,000 calories a day thinking and strategizing and competing and savaging. They're all inside their head. And the physiology is identical to other organisms having wildly, energetically taxing outbursts of behavior, and it's all going on in the head there. And that is unprecedented. And that begins to tell us why we as a species get stress-related diseases that other species don't. Other species turn on stress responses when somebody's trying to eat them. We turn on stress responses thinking about our heart's going to stop beating someday or something like that. You do that chronically. You use a system involved for very different reasons, and you get yourself into all sorts of health problems. So sometimes what's amazing about us is we're the exact same off-the-rack mammal as anybody else, but we're using that physiology in completely novel realms. So the third category where we've got something going on that is simply not found elsewhere in the animal world. Let me give you an example of this, and somewhat shocking one. Okay, you have this couple. They come home from work, they talk, they have dinner, they talk, they go to bed, they have sex, they talk, they fall asleep. The next day, they do the same exact thing. They come home, they talk, they eat, they talk, they go to bed, they have sex, they talk, they go to bed. They do this every night for 30 days in a row. Hippos would be repulsed by this. Nobody out there has that sort of non-reproductive sex, and nobody talks about it afterward. They're getting into all sorts of aspects of language and novel realms of sexuality and aggression, and in those realms, we have no precedent. So now we begin to consider, where do we fit within the animal world? And the theme here is obviously going to be, oh, the things that we used to think defined us and made us unique, it's no longer the case. And some of those are absolutely easy to deal with by now. We are 30 years into Jane Goodall finding that we're not the only species that makes tools, and that like caused various social anthropologists to fling themselves out windows 30 years ago. Yes, we're not the only species that makes tools. But the realms that are really challenging are much, much more interesting and much more subtle. Where over and over here we are going to see a theme, some of the most defining features of what we're about, we're not all that unique. But then you look closely, and we are very, very unique. So starting with some of these, starting with the notion of aggression. Okay, what did we always get when we look at those like National Geographic specials or some such thing? At the end, you'd get this stentorian voice going on about, we are the only species that kills our own kind of, and that turns out not to be true at all. Murder is widespread in all sorts of species out there. High levels of aggression. We are not the only organisms that kill other members of their own species, and we're not the only ones that will do it in particularly savage ways. This is a male who joined one of my baboon troops some years ago, and the only way to describe this guy is he had horrible political skills. He was passed on all sorts of guys he shouldn't have gone anywhere near, and one night a coalition of six of them ganged up on him, and this was what was left of him in the morning. And over the 30 years I've studied these animals, the leading cause of death of male baboons is male baboons. So we're not the only species that kills. We're not the only species that does it in an organized manner. And in this horrible slide, you will see these are four male chimps doing a border patrol, perhaps something that Goodall talked about when she was here, which is organized surveillance of the territorial edge, where if they encounter a male from the other group, they will attack him, they will kill him. As Goodall documented years ago, at the point of eradicating another group entirely, that we are not the only species that has organized violence or has the capacity for something resembling genocide. Killing all the members of the group simply because they are of that group. And what is going on here has a lot to do with the social structure of chimps. These are all either brothers or cousins. And what we see here is one of the truly scary things out in the primate world, which is males getting along with each other. Because often they are going to be terrifying to the neighbors. So we're not the only species that does that sort of thing. But then we look at the ways in which we're absolutely unique with aggression. We are just like any other primate. We are capable of using a stick or a rock or whatever and bludgeoning somebody to death. And we can have 500,000 people done in that way in Rwanda in 1990 with no more technology than was in place for 20,000 years. We can do that, but we can also do nothing more physically taxing than pull a trigger or look the other way or release a bomb in 30,000 feet below us and village is wiped out or damn somebody with faint praise or say something snitty about their hairdo and be wildly aggressive. We can be passive aggressive. We can also, how's this? This is the height of the subtlety of human aggression. I read about this recently. This is an Air Force base in Nevada where every morning guys who work there and do this particular job get up in the morning at home and they kiss their family goodbye and their wife reminds them to drop off the videos at the Blockbuster and they rush off to work where they sit down in an enclosed room in front of a big computer panel and what they do is they control drone planes in Iraq on bombing missions. The person sits there in this air-conditioned room in their base there in Nevada, bombing and killing people in Iraq. And at the end of the day, they rush out in traffic to get to their daughter's play on time because they're drunk with how much they love her. And the next morning, they go back to sitting in a room and pulling levers and killing people 12,000 miles away. And not surprisingly, there's an astonishingly high rate of psychiatric problems among these people. We can do aggression like nobody else out there, but we're doing aggression just like everybody else out there. So realms where we have our uniqueness still intact. Next category, something that psychologists call theory of mind, something we absolutely love. Theory of mind is this thing that happens during development. The first time you understand that other individuals have different information than you do. Other individuals know stuff that you don't, that your mind is not just this big sort of boundless continuum into everybody else's mind, that other individuals exist and have different thoughts. And developmental psych people see this as a critical precursor to empathy. You can't figure out how to feel somebody else's feelings until you know there is another who has different things going over their heads. So all these sorts of tests where you give a child information in a story, but where some other individual in the story doesn't have the information, what do they predict that that individual will do? And up to around 3-4 years of age, they can't understand that that character doesn't know the same thing that they do. And somewhere around age 4 or 5, you get theory of mind, and it's great, and everybody gets their theses out of it, and it's terrific, and you're not the only species that has theory of mind. This has been shown recently in chimpanzees. And in the study, these are captive chimps, and what you do is you have an enclosure. There's a chimp here and a chimp there, and they're kept in an enclosed room or something. And in the middle, you come out and put some bananas in the middle there. So what happens? Just to have good control, on either side of the bananas, there's a screen. Screens that are transparent. And the whole issue becomes, under some circumstances, you can put a screen in there that's not transparent. It's opaque. And you discover that chimps have very clear theory of mind. So you're a chimp sitting there, and eventually they're going to open the door, and you have to decide, am I going to sprint out there to try to get the banana at the same time that other guy is coming out? And they have these very clear rules. If the other guy is big and scary, and they put down a transparent screen, in other words, he saw there were bananas there, don't go for them, because I'm not going to get them. On the other hand, if there's another guy there who's big and scary, but they put down an opaque screen on that side of the bananas, he doesn't know they're there. I have theory of mind. I know that he doesn't know something I know, and they go for the bananas. And then so in the social context of it, if the other guy there isn't big and scary, it doesn't matter if he sees it or not, you go for the bananas. They understand the basics of theory of mind. So that's great. However, what no chimp on earth has is what the psychologist terms secondary theory of mind, which is being able to understand that that character understands something different than that character, to be able to do that detachment there. And that's why chimps can't understand what's going on in Midsummer Night's Dream. That's that one thinks that, they don't know that that one knows that and that. So you can carry in mind in a very fancy realm. Next example, the golden rule, do unto others, or in an equal number of culture, don't do it as to others as you would not want to be done to you. And it's probably interesting which one has it and which framing. But that is a centerpiece of human morality. of the Golden Rule and reciprocity and cooperation and this whole issue of, are we the only cooperative species out there who will do it with non-relatives, who will do it in highly ornate ways, and how did we wind up cooperating anyway? Because you think in evolutionary terms, and it's nature, blood, and tooth, and claw, and whoever started evolving cooperation was up the creek because they were behind in any sort of competition, and how did this happen? How is it that we're an altruistic species, and more so than anybody else? Now, this has been a whole issue that's dominated this whole field called game theory. Game theory, which is essentially taking competitive interactions and in very mathematical ways, breaking them down into their building blocks. And this is stuff studied by diplomats and economists and war strategists and things of that, and the evolutionary biologists discovered game theory about 30 years ago. And it was built around what is the sort of, you know, fruit fly of game theory research, a game called the Prisoner's Dilemma. And when you've gotten the Prisoner's Dilemma, there's two players, and they're prisoners who've escaped, and they've been caught, and are they supposed to tattle on the other guy? They agree to cooperate, but should they stab the other guy? And it's set up with a reward matrix. If both of the individuals cooperate, they each get a certain reward. If you, as one of them, if you cooperate and the other guy cheats, you lose a bunch of points and that person gets lots, they've just taken advantage of you. On the other hand, if the other person cooperates and you stab them in the back there, you get lots of points and they lose, and if you both cheat, you both lose. So you look at that and you ask, okay, when do you cheat and when do you cooperate? This is the basic issue of playing Prisoner's Dilemma. And about 30 years ago, an economist named Robert Axelrod programmed the Prisoner's Dilemma, and he asked a gazillion people to give him their strategy. How would you go about playing the Prisoner's Dilemma? He asked mathematicians, he asked economists, he asked generals, he asked Nobel Peace Prize winners, he asked boxers, he asked, and he got all these strategies, programmed them in, and ran them through hundreds of thousands of generations on the computer, allowed them to have natural selection. And which strategy outcompeted all the others, and out came this one with these incredibly ornate strategies, one which was tit for tat. You start off cooperating, and if the person cooperates back, you keep cooperating forever. If they cheat or stab you in the back once, the next time you cheat and stab in the back in return, and if they've gone back to cooperating, then you go back. Tit for tat outcompetes every other strategy. Or as the terms were used, it drives all the other strategies into extinction. So people looked at this, and they got incredibly excited and said, let's go see, are there any things that look like tit for tat among non-human species that have cooperation? And it turns out to be exactly the case. Vampire bats. Okay, vampire bats, none of us like vampire bats. They're going, they're sucking your blood and all of that. And it turns out what the vampire bat is doing is she's just a mommy trying to feed her babies. Why are you hassling her and all of that? Vampire bats, when they go and land on cows and they suck their blood, they're not actually drinking it. They store it in a throat sac and they fly back to their nest and they disgorge the blood to feed their babies. But not only that, they disgorge blood to feed everybody else's babies in the colony. All the females feed each other's babies. It's this reciprocally altruistic system. Now, thanks to the vile researcher on the scene, manipulating things to make the bats think that one of them is cheating. Bat comes flying out, and you net the bat, and you take her, and you pump up her throat sac with air, and you put her back in the nest. And of course she doesn't feed anybody because she doesn't have any blood there, and everybody else is saying, look at that, look at the amount of blood she's got in her neck, and she's not feeding my kids. I can't believe she's going to have around, none of the females feed her kids. They tit for tat her back. Another example, you know, we don't think of bats as being all these cognitively advanced creatures. The next example involves stickleback fish, and these are not sort of all that fast in the neuron lane. Stickleback fish and tit for tat as well. Here's how you show it. You take a fish, and fish is in the tank there, and you put a mirror up against it, and we all know that one. What the fish is going to do is bash its face against the mirror, defending its territory against this invading fish for the rest of the time. Now you make the fish believe it has a coalitional partner. You take a second mirror, and you put it perpendicular to it. So now, each time it's going at that image, it's seeing this fish next to it doing the same thing. It's like, I have no idea who that guy is, but he is great. He's the best guy. And now you make him think the other guy is cheating on him. You take the mirror and you angle it back a bit so the reflection is set back. So you're there and you're pounding your face there and you're saying, oh yeah, he's just pretending to go forward. I see him leaning back there. Son of a bitch, I'm blistering my lips here. And the next time around, you put the mirror down, he doesn't attack his image. He believes he's tit-for-tatting the guy back. So that's amazing. That's amazing that this mathematically optimal evolved strategy has evolved in all sorts of species. We're not the only one who does tit for tat or has the golden rule, do unto others. But it's not until you look at us that you deal with a more complicated version, which is not do unto others as others do unto you, but recognizing that somebody else may want different things in your reciprocal interaction, and we're the only species who could possibly make sense of something like that. It's a very, very separate domain today. Next, empathy. Empathy, the thing that defines us and separates us from the animals, and we're not the only species with something that looks like empathy. And this afternoon in the talk, we were discussing this. This was work, wonderful work, done by this primatologist, Franz de Waal, showing something that sure looks like empathy amongst chimps. Here's the scenario. You got a chimp who is sitting there minding his own business, and some high-ranking guy has just pummeled him savagely. Second scenario, you have a chimp who starts a fight with someone and gets pummeled savagely. And what he shows is in the hour afterward, the chimp who was the innocent bystander is now groomed at a higher rate than usual. And the chimp who asked for it is now groomed at a lower rate than usual. In other words, chimps not only cognitively can understand what causality is there, this guy didn't ask for it and this guy started the whole thing, they feel more of an affiliative response to the poor innocent bystander than the guy who started it. That sure looks like some sort of building block of empathy. So yeah, we're not the only ones who can do empathy, but then we look at the sort of things we can be empathic about. So a starting example here. And what we have here is a dog whose paw was caught in a trap and whose paw has been necrotic enough to fall off. There's a lot. And I'm looking out here right now and various faces are recoiling. You are feeling pain, you are feeling empathy for an organism that is not of your species. There is nothing like this out there in the animal world. But we can do something even more abstract. We could look at a painting and we can know its context and historical setting for a town being destroyed in the Spanish Civil War, and we can look at that horse and feel badly for a horse that you knew had to have gone through this fire. We can feel badly for an imaginary horse, but we can take it one step further. This is a painting by a German neo-expressionist named Franz Marc, who was yet another person destroyed by the trench warfare in World War I, who shortly after coming out of the trenches and shortly before killing himself, did this painting which he called The Fate of the Animals. And this is a world of chaos exactly as you would expect of somebody who just came out the other end of World War I in the trenches. And what you see here, terribly in fact, well, you'll have to believe me, what you see in the middle there is an animal reaching upward, baying at the moon amid all of this chaos, and you can't even tell what species this animal is. It's not an identifiable species, and you look at this, and you don't feel badly for that animal, you feel badly for the animals. You feel badly for the planet. You feel bad and empathy in realms that no other organism can dream of. So yes, we're not the only ones with empathy, but we've got domains for it that are simply unmatched. Next, this realm of pleasure and gratification postponement of these things that define us as humans, and it's not so unique anymore. And much of this has to do with a neurotransmitter, a brain chemical called dopamine. Dopamine communicates, is used to communicate between neurons in a certain part of the brain, and for centuries people have known dopamine is about pleasure. Cocaine releases dopamine, all sorts of euphorian drugs work on the dopamine system. Dopamine is about pleasure, but it turns out it's not about pleasure. Here's what you would expect. You give an animal a reward and you release dopamine in these pathways because it's just got a reward and feeling pleasure. That's not what you see. Here's the sort of paradigm that would show what's happening instead. You train a monkey, for example, on a certain task, where when the light comes on in the room, it means we're starting this task now. It means go over to the lever on that side, and now every 10 times you press it, you get a food reward. So this signals the start of the task, and the monkey goes over and presses the lever, and after a certain delay, it gets the food reward. If dopamine was about pleasure, it would have the rise right after you get the food reward. That's not what happens. Dopamine goes up as soon as the light comes on saying we're starting this task. It's the monkey sitting there saying, I know this one. I know just how to do this. Yep, I got this one under. I'm all over. Great. So maybe I just need to go over that. And it's not about pleasure. It's about the anticipation of pleasure. And it's about the ability to fuel behavior based on that anticipation. Because if you block that rise in dopamine after the light comes on, the monkey never presses the lever. It's the anticipation that drives it to do that behavior. It's the dopamine. And here's an amazing, brilliant elaboration on this that was published a couple years ago. Okay, press the lever 10 times, you get a food pellet, press it 10 times, food pellet, 100% reward rate. Now have a 50% reward rate. Unpredictably, averaging out to 50% of the time. What happens to dopamine? As soon as the light comes on, dopamine boosts up higher than you will ever see it in this part of the brain. What have you just introduced into your neurochemical equation? You've just introduced the word maybe. And maybe is addictive like nothing you can imagine. And that's the light comes on there. Yeah, I'm all over this, but it didn't work last time, and I'm really terrible at this, and I'm nervous about it. This kind of thing. And you are cranking out dopamine like crazy, showing how this is what's going on. Now, instead of 50% reward rate, have either a 25 or 75% reward rate. These are diametrically opposite. This is good news, that's bad news. They have nothing in common other than there's less of a maybe, and there's less of a rise in dopamine in both of these cases. It's about the anticipation of the reward. It's about the willingness to work for that reward. It's about the maybe injected in there. And we are brilliant at engineering that, where you think that maybe asymptote comes from. And that's what they do in Las Vegas. The entire purpose of Las Vegas is to take a realm where the reward rate is 1/100 of 1%, and to make you think that you, and especially you, and especially you today, instead have the curve way over on the other side. The whole notion is to make you think you were dealing with uncertain reward in a benevolent environment. And this drives dopamine like crazy. So how's that in other species? And what you see is this was first discovered in other species. Other species can work for reward, work for reward with a certain delay, but what we obviously can do is hold our breath. The lag time between the task completed and when the reward comes, we can just maintain that burst of anticipatory dopamine like nobody else out there. And before you know it, we're the species that studies hard to get a good grade, to get into a good college, to get into a good grad school, to get into a good job, to get into a good nursing home, and like all the And depending on your cultural mindset, you can hold on to a reward that does not come until the afterlife. You can maintain and generate behavior driven by dopamine and anticipation, and with an element of maybe big time for motivating behavior, and we can keep that system going for decades. And that's unprecedented. Finally, shifting into another realm. And this is now where we leave that second category, oh, we do the same thing as everybody else, but just in different ways. And this is moving into something that is absolutely without any similarity in the world out there with other species. And this is this realm of human behavior where the more certainly something cannot be the case, the more certainly it must be, and the more certainly you must act that way. Here's a wonderful example of this. This is a nun, Sister Helen Prejean, who was the person featured in the movie Dead Man Walking. What she spends her time with is prisoners on death row ministering to their needs, and my God, she's been attacked by the family members of victims. How can you do this? And a remarkable quote from her, which was, "The more unforgivable the act, the more it must be forgiven. And the more unlovable the person, the more you must love them." And this is logically impossible. And this is an absolute prerequisite for doing something like this. And this is at the core of something unmatched in us. And as an atheist, this strikes me as the most magnificently irrational thing we can do as a species. So what we've got here, in some cases, we're just like every other animal, and in really interesting realms, we kind of look more and more like them until you look closely, and then in some of the most remarkable ways, there is nothing else like us on this planet. Okay, so that's a sense of us in the realm of animal behavior and primates and evolution. How about us in the realm of just being a big old bunch of neurons? And where we begin to get some insight into this is some famous event in the annals of computer history. And this was a decade ago, probably more by now, where the chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov, who I guess is considered to be the strongest chess grandmaster of all time, went in a tournament against a computer that was built by the folks at IBM called Deep Blue. And in this famous landmark of computer history, Kasparov, I think, won the first match, and then the computer mopped the floor with him for the remainder of the tournament and crushed the guy. And this was the first time anything like this had happened. And apparently in the aftermath, Kasparov was like utterly depressed, and his friends were trying to make him feel better. And they said, okay, what we've got here with this computer, this is nothing to get like upset about because it doesn't matter. Okay, chess grandmasters, apparently what they have is an unworldly ability to intuit what interesting parts are on the board there and to see half a dozen steps ahead as to what could happen. This is like otherworldly, that this could be done. And what they emphasized to him was, given the computational power of this computer, that computer could play out every iteration for 10 moves ahead and simply see what was the best outcome for every single step. And they said to him, you don't need to be upset about it. All that computer was about is quantity. And he said, yeah, but with enough quantity, you invent quality. And that's the key thing. Again, we have the same sort of neurons as fireflies do, but we have 100 million of them for every one that that has, and somewhere with enough of those building blocks, with enough quantity, we invent quality. So what sort of qualities emerge from our nervous systems? I'm beginning one that gives us, again, a whole lot of insight into what makes us a species. Part of our brain called the frontal cortex. Now, I've spent the last 25 years of my life studying a region of the brain called the hippocampus, and it has struck me recently that this was a tragically misspent quarter century in my life. The frontal cortex is so interesting. Hippocampus, there's a little memory, you want to have a hippocampus, you're up to creep without one. Frontal cortex is really interesting. Frontal cortex is the most evolved part of the brain in humans. We've got more frontal cortex than any other species out there. It's the most recently evolved. Proportionately, it is way bigger. It's the last part of the brain to develop. What does the frontal cortex do? It makes you do the harder thing when the easier thing would be stupid. It makes you not say exactly what you want to say at that point. It makes you not become the serial murderer. It makes you say, this is the most amazing, wonderful dinner. I need the recipe when you're close to retching. It makes you do this morning. And we've got frontal cortex like crazy. And when you lose your frontal cortex, things happen. Every day, every one of us, no doubt, has some thoughts that are boastful or lustful or petulant or where we would die if anybody knew we were thinking that. And you get your frontal cortex damaged, and every time you think one of those things, you say it. And you do it. And the most famous example, the most famous patient in the history of neurology, a man named Phineas Gage, back in the 1840s, working building railroad lines, a very sober, reliable, religious worker, foreman of his, and there was a dynamite accident which blew a metal rod through the front of his head out the other side, and as we now know historically from work reconstructing from his skull, which is on display in Harvard's Medical School Museum, it took out his frontal cortex. And he famously overnight turned into a drunken, hyper-aggressive, hyper-sexual bully. He was never able to work again for the rest of his life. Interestingly, he's buried without his skull in coma. And I don't quite know how that happened, but I don't know where and where the head managed to get over to Boston. But this is the most famous patient showing damage to the frontal cortex, and you think things and you do them. And this has a very interesting implication in the criminal realm, which is you have disorders of frontal damage where somebody knows the difference between right and wrong, but yet they cannot regulate their behavior. A substantial percentage of men on death row in this country have a history of concussive head trauma in the fronts of their heads. And blow out this part of the brain, and doing the harder thing when the easier thing is more tempting and disastrous becomes a very difficult thing to do. Now, as I noted, the frontal cortex is the last part of the brain to fully develop. It is not completely online until you are 25 years old. Think about that. And look at kids. Kids don't have much frontal cortex. Okay, you take a kid. Here's how you show exactly how much frontal function a child has. You take your four-year-old, and I did this hundreds of times with my children, and it's difficult to see. You take your four-year-old, and okay, so you play hide and seek, and okay, you're it, and they go hide somewhere in the house, and they're counting, and then up to ten, and say, "Ray, you're not here." I come, and they say, "Here I am. I'm looking for you. Where are you?" And they instantly say, "I'm here under the piano." They switch at that point, and they're there, and they count 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. They've just learned all these numbers, and they're so excited about them, and they can't stop themselves, and they just keep counting through the numbers because they've got 7 frontal neurons wired up. Suddenly, it's not until you're suddenly 25, it's not by chance that 7-year-olds are not setting up IRAs and worrying about long-term stuff, and that is the last part of the brain to become fully online. Critical implication there. If that's the last part of the brain to fully mature, it's the part of the brain that is most shaped by environment and least by genetics. So we've got this part of the brain that is fascinating. Fascinating in terms of, oh, implications for criminal law, all of that. Fascinating when we sit there and realize the person sitting next to you has a different number of frontal neurons than you do, and different distribution of neurotransmitter receptors, and different number of synapses, and suddenly we're not just thinking about them and their brain damage, but we're beginning to think about why some of us can tell the waiter the food is undercooked and please take it back, or why some of us can speak in public, or why some of us can connect with other individuals, or why some of us can't be faithful, or can't hold on to money, or we're suddenly in a realm where this is very defining of who we are in this one part of the brain. More features. Here's a neurological disease, which if you have a choice in the matter, you do not want to get. This is Huntington's disease, Huntington's chorea. And it involves degeneration in a part of the brain with fine motor control. You begin to get a tremor, and eventually progresses to the point that your entire body is flailing. Technical term, you have hemibolismus, ballistic flinging of your limbs. You do it 24/7. It eventually kills you because you choke to death on your saliva. Nightmare of a disease. But that's not what Huntington's disease looks like when it's first starting. Here's what it looks like. You've got a 40-year-old guy, happily married, living in the suburbs, working the same job forever, 2.3 kids, everything's great, and suddenly, one day, he punches somebody at work. Some guy, they're standing by the water cooler, makes a comment about some basketball game, and he punches him in the face. He hasn't done this since junior high school. Utterly bizarre. So you file it away. And then 2 months later, his wife of 20 years happy marriage discovers he's having an affair with a 17-year-old checkout kid at the Safeway. Then 2 months later, he's arrested for drawing drunkenly in a bar, and he never even used to drink. And then 2 months later, he embezzles all the funds from his workplace, disappears, and is never heard from again. Until 2 years later, he shows up in a neurology ward somewhere because he began to get trembling. 2 to 3 years before, Huntington's disease is a neuromuscular disorder. It's a psychiatric one. People do all sorts of imprudent things. One part of the brain is destroyed long before these motor systems, the frontal cortex. It's initially a disease of the frontal cortex. More examples of disinhibition. This is one of the famous neurologists of all time. This is Gilles Tellat-Tourette. He was the most famous cursor of the 19th century, and he also gave rise to a neurological disease he first described, Tourette syndrome. We all know about Tourette syndrome, which is uncontrolled cursing, scatology. That doesn't begin to describe the disease. People with Tourette's, yes, they curse uncontrollably, but they also have facial tics, they have body tics, they bark, they yip, they sing uncontrollably at times, they grab at their crotch, they grab at their throat, a whole storm of these tic-like behaviors. And Tourette's is a disaster for people who have it. Now, the thing about Tourette's is it's not like frontal damage. Frontal damage, oh my God, the thing we all think about doing but would never do, you actually do it. Tourette's is not like that. It's not like every one of us secretly wishes to quack the dog. There's many Tourette's patients who do that. It's not the person in there. Instead, it's this like hiccups of the id that are happening instead. This is not the person. And this is suddenly a very instructive thing for us in making sense of this, which is somewhere in there, we are making a distinction between the essence of who a person is and the biology that may be just buffeting them around. And this is a very challenging thing because we don't draw that line very readily in some places. 500 years ago, in most Western European countries, if you were an epileptic and in the process of having a seizure, you struck somebody else, most of those societies had an explanatory model for where epilepsy came from. You were possessed by the devil because of your sinful behavior. And epileptics were burned at the stake in extraordinary numbers. And somewhere around 100 years ago, instead, we developed the capacity to have one of the most defining humane things of our culture, which is the ability to say, it's not him, it's his disease. We're very good at doing that with epilepsy. We're lousy at doing that with, say, schizophrenia. 1980, when John Hinckley attempted to assassinate Reagan, Hinckley was a floridly paranoid schizophrenic, and a very, very wise jury said that this is a person who is not criminally liable, this is a person who is psychiatrically impaired, and the Neanderthal editorials bellowing about that throughout this country, the number of organic impairment defenses that were repealed throughout the country, our Congress immediately made it impossible to have that defense in a civil suit, in a federal crime, and the entire country was not very good at drawing the line between the essence of who John Hinckley was and the abnormal neurotransmitter levels. And we're really lousy at doing that, for example, in the realm of many parents and teachers of saying, where is the child and where is the dyslexia? And instead, words like lazy and stupid come out instead. And what we're learning here is we are going to have to draw a line between the essence of who somebody is and the biology buffeting them. We're going to have to draw those lines in areas we never would have guessed before. And this winds up being a great example. Because a few years ago, I had a student who had Tourette's, and he came into office hours at one point, and he wanted to talk to me about it, and he came into office hours, and he was describing he had the disease, and he was very pleased that like I knew about it, and he was saying that sometimes during exams, he might wind up making noise, and that could be a problem for your students there, and he heard, it's not that much of a problem, so I don't have that severe of a time, and he spent the entire time doing this. This was the Tourette's, this was the essence of who he was. And this is where we're at 500 years ago. Tourette's had an explanatory model too. It tends to become more severe around adolescence. You suddenly have an adolescent cursing uncontrollably sexual gestures. They are possessed and they are burned at the stake. 500 years ago, someone with this disease gets burned at the stake. These days, they take the MCATs in a separate room from everybody else and they don't disturb them with their barking. Gotten very good at drawing a line there between the essence of that person and the disease going on, but we are challenged in lots of other realms. More examples. Okay, here we have a highly technical diagram. This is, this is a NASA satellite photo, and on the left what we see is a tray of Rice Krispie Treats. And what we've now done is allow virtually any of us to be left alone in that room for an hour or so, and we'll come back later, and on the right is what that tray of Rice Krispie Treats will look like after. We will all take the knife sitting there, and we will trim out the parts sticking out of the meat. Why is that? It's because eating only a sliver doesn't count as cheating. Is it because we understand by decreasing the surface area, you make it stay on that much longer? No, it just like, gets on our nerves that there's a piece sticking out there. Every one of us at some point or another during a period of stress or anxiety will find we're counting steps when we go up a flight of stairs or some stupid jingle gets stuck in our head or we have this incredibly important letter and we go to mail it and we go to the mailbox and we make sure it goes down because this is really important and we check again just to make sure this is really important. We all do, actually, maybe we all do that. I'm embarrassing myself. We fall into rituals, obsessions, compulsions, during periods of anxiety. We try to get structured times when we don't feel it in the world around us. But then there's the psychiatric disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, where it takes over your life and destroys you. These people spend 6, 7, 8 hours a day washing. They cannot leave their homes because they cannot get the rituals straight. They spend all of their time circling and circling a blanket like a dog wanting to lie down and never being able to stop. Who would have thought there can be a psychiatric disorder that cripples you because you spend all of your time thinking about prime numbers or trying to make the utensils symmetrical? These are realms of abnormalities, realms of biology destroying us that we could never have imagined. More examples. As we learn about diseases like obsessive compulsive disorder, we know what part of the brain is abnormal. There's beginning to be genes identified that are risk factors, and this produces a disease where you are destroyed by having a TV jingle go on in your head 10 hours a day, and you can't make it stop. But it gets even stranger. This is one of my favorite psychiatric disorders. This is a disease called Jerusalem syndrome. And you can suffer from Jerusalem syndrome only in Jerusalem. And it involves typically a very interesting subset of individuals. You cannot have Jerusalem syndrome if you're clinically depressed, if you're anxious, if you're psychotic, if you're schizophrenic. You better rule all those out. You are mentally healthy when you succumb to Jerusalem syndrome. In order to get Jerusalem syndrome, almost without exception, you have to be an American Southern Baptist. You have to arrive there in a tour group. This is your first visit to the Holy Land. You are there by yourself. You do not have family members, and you're having a lot of trouble with jet lag. So here's what happens. You've spent your entire life saving up to do this trip to finally go to the Holy Land and see the places where Jesus walked, and you get there, and instead there's traffic jams, and there's smog, and there's litter, and there's pickpockets, there's McDonald's, and you go back to your hotel room at night feeling deeply disappointed and deeply unnerved by it, and you're there by yourself in the room awake for hours at night because of the jet lag, and here's what happens. Without exception, literally in the medical journals, they just describe it, the person rips apart their hotel bed, pulls out the sheet, shreds it, takes off their clothes, makes a toga, and they're soon out on the street corner in Jerusalem preaching to people about how they have to go back to simpler ways. And they call out the SWAT team from the psychiatry hospital there. They take the person there, they keep them locked up there for a week or so, everything recovers fine, and they send them back to Biloxi or wherever they come from. They get 100 cases of this a year. And this is utterly rotten. Actually, if you want to cure Jerusalem syndrome, you should just have a checkered or a plaid sheets in all the hotel rooms. Just have the sheets and make a white toga. What kind of disease is this? 100 people a year, 2 people a week this happens to. Things get even stranger. Here we have a psychiatric disorder of people who compulsively eat hair. They pull out their hair, they chew on their hair while they're speaking, but at an extreme form, it is a nightmare. They are at somebody's house and they sneak off to the bathroom to take the brushes out of the bathroom and pull out their hair. They pull out all their own hair. It is a whole class of psychiatric disorders of compulsively eating hair until you get yourself into a special designation when you eat so much hair that it forms a hairball and clogs your stomach. And at that point, they need to go in and cut open your stomach and pull this out, or else you will die. And here we see one of these hairballs having the shape of the stomach inside. They're heading all the way up the esophagus. And what is this disease called? It's called Rapunzel syndrome because of the elongated hair. Okay, last example, and this one is so bizarre and involves such strangely named diseases, I'm not even going to try to pronounce this. But these are two psychiatric disorders. The first one is like nothing. The first one is so like obvious and straightforward. This is the disease of people who can only be sexually aroused by amputees. Okay, so that's what that one's called. These are like the kids next door compared to the next disease. The second is a disorder of people who have always thought of themselves as amputees and never feel quite right until they lose a limb. And in this disorder, there are chat lines online. There are all of these people who suffer from this giving each other advice for how to stage industrial accidents, the news of them. And this is a real psychiatric disorder. And as described by the first psychiatrist who reported it, an entirely new way of being mad. Look at these waves. Most of these diseases I just showed you about, they did not exist 50 years ago. They existed plenty, but we did not have names for them. All of these were discovered more recently, and we are being forced to draw this line between who the person is and the neurochemical hiccups in realms we would never have anticipated. So what's going to happen with this? Most of these were described in the last 50 years. Most of these, there weren't even ways to give names for how your life could be destroyed these ways. And now they have names, and what's going to happen? There's going to be more and more of these names. And what happens when somewhere down the line, there's enough of these that every one of us has two or three of these diagnoses? When I am tired, when I am stressed, I count steps when I go up and down stairs, and I can't stop myself. I have stupid jingles stuck in my head. Every time I go into a Chinese restaurant, I order the exact same thing. Every time beforehand, I sit there and say, don't do it, you're taking this preservative drug. And suddenly, the guys are going to get all flustered, and suddenly I'm like, you know, ordering broccoli and garlic, and it's happened again. I do not have obsessive compulsive disorder, but I certainly have elements of it at times, as do lots of people in here. As do lots of people in here have elements of these other ones, and at some point, as enough of these names and titles and labels wind up being thrown about, it's going to stop being the science of them and their diseases, and it's going to be describing what makes all of us us. And at that point, we've got some potentially very complex implications in our hands. Some of those implications are terrifying. Because God help you if you get some of those labels and you are poor or poorly connected, because that's just where our society loves to find grounds for denying you health care and health insurance and fair housing and a job and all of that. That is certainly one scary realm. And the bigger version of that has ample history, which is the temptation that once you think you can describe something, you decide you're describing something that's broken and something that ain't broken you're trying to fix. And there is no shortage in our history of scientists who are happy to march into hell, goose-stepping hand in hand with people whose notion of normality in humans required an Aryan profile. So there's always going to be that danger. But at the same time, the positive thing that could come out of that is 500 years ago, burning epileptics at the stake, and these days, we could recognize that a psychiatric disorder where you have numbers marching in your head is something that can destroy you and something that leads people to have to protect. And we are going to be forced to send an umbrella of care and compassion in directions we could never have imagined. And when we get to the point of recognizing it's the same neurochemistry writ large that makes a schizophrenic utterly delusional and believe they're the Empress of California, it's the same brain chemistry that allows us to have a 30-second fantasy about somebody on a magazine cover when we're waiting online at the checkout in the supermarket, when it's the same continuum with any luck we're going to get trained to recognize kinship in areas we never would have dreamt of before. There, but for the grace of God, I would have seven more of those receptors in my brain, or two fewer of those enzymes, and that could be me. Hopefully this will move us into realms of compassion that we could not have imagined before. But to finish here, what I've always found to be the most disturbing aspects of this, when people first learn about it, is not, oh, social policy and what this will do to health insurance and the national debt, or who knows what, but where it begins to strike very close to home. And I find a substantial percentage of my students, when first learning this stuff, at some point get unnerved, get the willies, get very, very personally threatened by some of it. Because it speaks to one of the great pretenses we all have, which is that each one of us is this sparkling flame of individuality and uniqueness that is never going to be explainable and describable. And suddenly, here we have these scientists learning more and more about less and less and threatening to inadvertently explain everything. And where will that leave us? And there's a wonderful science fiction story that perfectly captures that fear, a story by Arthur C. Clarke called The 9 Billion Names of God. And in this story, there was a bunch of computer scientists and a bunch of Tibetan monks, and apparently in traditional Tibetan society, there's thought to be 9 billion names for God, metaphor for the unknowable. And in this story, these computer scientists have programmed this computer to generate all 9 billion names of God along with these monks. And as the story goes, as they're all standing there, and each new name is churned out, one of the stars in the sky goes dark. And that being this metaphor for, as we learn more and more about less and less, and turn all of this into nothing but equations and biochemical reactions, as we learn all of this, the stars in the heavens will be extinguished, and we will be left that much poorer afterward. There is never this danger. There is not this danger if science inadvertently goes and explains everything. You can understand Bach in terms of contrapuntal structure. You could turn gazelles leaping into biomechanics, and that should not take away one iota our capacity to be moved by those things. Just because there's levels of structure and explanation we didn't recognize at first does not rob us of that response. But the bigger reason why we don't need to be worried about this is ultimately at the end, science is never going to go and accidentally explain everything. That's not going to happen. What should be clear throughout this whole talk is every time we've gotten an answer to something, we generate 10 more questions, 7 of which were better than the ones we started with. And this is perfectly caught, finishing here, this famous quoted geneticist named Haldane, who once said, "Life is not only stranger than we imagine, life is stranger than we can imagine." And ultimately, the purpose of science is not to cure us of our sense of mystery, it's to constantly reinvent it and reinvigorate it. So on that note, thank you for your attention, and let me finish here. Study there is basically, these are wild populations of baboons in the national park in Kenya, and what I study is who gets stress-related diseases there, who gets the high blood pressure, who gets the rotten cholesterol levels, who gets the ulcers, what does it have to do with your social rank, your personality, which is a real term talking about non-human primates, and who gets them. And as part of it, I have to anesthetize these animals and take blood and tissue samples and all of that. And over the years, like 90% of the work I've done is with males. And it's for a simple reason, because basically I'm way too afraid of the females. This has to do with the fact, okay, baboons have this social structure where males leave the truth that they're born and they leave around adolescence and they transfer into an adult truth, the opposite of chicks. So females spend their whole life in the same tree, and male adults have come from someplace else. So when I was first starting to sort of figure out how to do this darting 3 years ago, to thinking, oh my God, like some male is gonna like collapse unconscious, and I'm the one who goes over and has to pick him up, and I'm gonna get ripped to pieces by these guys. It's terrifying. And that turns out not to be the problem. You dart one of these guys, and he's getting all wobbly because the anesthetic's starting to work, and this is number 3 doing this, who suddenly falls over, and number 4 is sitting there watching, saying, I don't know what's up with him, but wouldn't this be a great time to slash his throat open? I don't have to protect myself from the other males, I have to protect the guy I darted from the other males. Females are different. Females spend their whole life in the same troop, so you dart a female, and you've got her mother and her 2 sisters and all of her kids and friends trying to rip you apart. They're much scarier to dart than males. Thank God the males don't get along. That's the only way I can study them. Yes, no, I don't have issues.
I have a question. Started talking about aggression, and there have been many primatologists who like to talk about how humans are inherently aggressive, and it's part of our dark primate past. What do you think about statements like that?
break. No, that's one of the, we are spectacularly unprecedentedly aggressive in some settings. We are spectacularly unprecedented. We adopt people from the other side of the planet, laying sort of belying any of the logic of knee-jerk social biology, saying that everything we do is built around reproductive maximization and genetic. We're incredibly aggressive, we're incredibly unaggressive. What is, I think, most unique about it is how unconstrained we are by our nature. In any of that, in other words, how readily manipulated we are, how readily manipulated, a pejorative way of stating it, or how readily inspired we can be by setting all of that, it is our nature to not be constrained by nature in that regard. And so, some room for optimism there.
All right. You've mentioned experiments with primates. Are the primates you use treated humanely, and do you encourage other scientists to be humane also?
Okay. Yes, these are guys. These are wild baboons. They live freely in a national park in Kenya. These are, I don't know how to begin to frame this, but these are animals I've known for the majority of my life. And I think I make every effort to be humane with them, and I make every effort to protect them in all sorts of unlikely, unfortunate circumstances of human interactions that could be damaging to them. You know, this is a critical thing to do. In terms of making sure that other people do so, science has a moderately successful policing system for animal care, and I think it's a function of how motivated the people are in the policing role, and something I do, all of us are constantly asked to review somebody's grant or review a paper, oh, that nobody has time for it. If it's one involved in primate use, I always do it. And I'm always looking for primate care issues in there. Is it being organized?
Another question. Did I understand you to say you're an atheist? And if so, what do you think of the faith of someone like Helen Prudhomme?
Yes, I'm an atheist, but that I was raised intensely religiously in a very, very orthodox religious tradition, and something happened when I was about 14, and not only has there not been any religion since, there's been no spirituality since, and there's not a week that goes by where I wish that weren't the case, but it doesn't happen. When I look at someone like Helen Prejean, all you can do is be awestruck at what a human is capable of. There's absolutely nothing about it that requires a religious framework for reaching that point. There's no absence of precedence for religious frameworks that move in much the opposite direction. Simply the way our societies are structured, though, both of those extremes are more readily accomplished through the religious framework of explanation and motivation. But once again, we are easily manipulated in one way or the other. It takes more work to go in either direction if you have a large explanatory model. But nonetheless, that's the one I'm stuck with. She's magnificent, but it doesn't require the sister coming at the beginning of the name.
Okay. Suicide bombers and militant Islam confound me. Can your insights into human behavior help explain the new terrorism?
No. No, okay. Well, I've actually been reading a lot about this because it is quite puzzling. The standard old model of terrorists, the old model when being a terrorist did not involve you killing yourself in the process with any luck, that had a fairly consistent pair of profiles. One was this wild idealist who knew very little about how the world worked, and the other was sort of the 20-year-old sociopath model. And that was the version of, if this person hadn't latched on to this cause, they'd be out mugging old ladies for their pocketbooks, and instead they're doing things considerably more violent within some framework of a claim for it. And from what I've read, most of the people who took part in the Boston Tea Party fit that profile. They would have been out mugging people in the streets of Boston otherwise. So those are the two profiles. The more frequent one, an emphasized endlessly with IRA gun and the 20-year-old sociopath model is the much more frequent one, socially isolated, long history of antisocial behavior. The terrorist bombers do not fit any of these. And the Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, to begin with, violate all the rules. They are not poor on the average by background. They are not poorly educated by background. They statistically have very little personal exposure to the things of repression that they are protesting against. For example, West Bank Palestinian terrorists have a very low rate of actually having a family member who is directly touched by the Israeli occupation, and that violates all the rules. And by the time you get to the suicide bombers, more rules go down the tubes. These are not the 20-year-old sociopathic males. They're 45-year-old engineers who kiss their families goodbye, make a videotape saying, I'll see you in paradise, and off they go. They're not 20-year-old sociopathic males. They're 18-year-old women with fiancés. And the common theme among all of them is an astonishingly strong religious framework, and one built around dealing with a cognitive dissonance. Islam is very, very clear that you do not kill non-combatants and you don't kill yourself, and it takes a lot of work to reconcile that with being a suicide bomber, but that lot of work is accomplished, and with an explanation at the other end of it that it's going to make you a paradise. And the common thing is tremendous, tremendous theological investment. And that puts you into realms of behavior that is not going to help explaining a whole lot by 20-year-olds who they didn't have this with the unloading people.
Okay, are any approaches to psychological stress proving effective in minimizing glucocorticoid elevations?
Yes. Okay, glucocorticoids is a hormone. I'm in love with these stress hormones, and they save your life. If you secrete them while you run for your life, if you secrete them for too long, you get all sorts of diseases. My angle is they kill neurons in the hippocampus, that part of the brain. They kill neurons in the frontal cortex with much more interesting implications. So these are hormones you don't want to have a whole lot of in your bloodstream. Chronic stress causes you to. So the question essentially being, do stress management techniques work? And yes, indeed, they absolutely do. Meditation, mindful meditation, transcendental meditation, prayer, aerobic exercise, playing your trombone with your building, all of them have the potential for having medically efficacious outcomes, lowering blood pressure, lowering cholesterol levels, decreasing the risk of a second heart attack, all that sort of thing, but they come with a whole bunch of provisos. First one is, it's got to be a stress management technique that reduces your sense of stress. Oh, really? What is that? Okay, an example. The studies are absolutely clear that meditation, transcendental meditation, can do things like reduce blood pressure. If I spent 20 minutes a day doing transcendental meditation, I would have a stroke. So antithetical to what I'm about. It's one of the philosophies. In other words, you know, your friends advocated wildly, read the fine print and figure out if it works for you. Okay, so it's got to be something that actually works. Here's a great demonstration of this. Turns out the brain makes new neurons in the adult brain, whole evolution. So people study what are the circumstances that caused you to make new neurons. Exercise does. But listen to this study. Take a lab rat, and it has a running wheel in its cage, and whenever it feels like running, it jumps in there and runs, and all of that. And under those circumstances, its brain makes more neurons, and it lowers its stress hormone, glucocorticoid levels. So now you have an experimental design where the next cage over has what's called a yoked design. There's a running wheel in that second cage. And there's a second rat inside that running wheel who can't get out of it. It's enclosed. And every time the first rat chooses to run, the second rat is forced to run. The same exact physical exercise. This one is voluntary. This one has no control. This rat makes more new neurons. This one makes less. So getting something that reflects control, interest, choice, all of that is critical. Second variable. You can't do your stress management on the weekends and save it for the weekend. You can't do it while you're on hold on the phone for 30 seconds. All of them need 20, 30 minutes of time set aside each day. It needs to be large committed blocks. And the willingness to make that commitment gets you halfway there right off the bat. The third, final proviso is do not trust anybody who says it's been scientifically proven that their brand works better than the others. Watch your wallet at that point, because that simply has not been shown. But amid all those caveats, they work wonders when done right. If our psychological nonsense can generate this stuff, we certainly have the capacity to be psychologically anchored enough to make some of it go away.
Okay. So, you spent 25 years studying the hippocampus. So what are the most amazing things you learned from that?
You want to have one. What's most interesting about it? I guess the ways in which the hippocampus is in some ways at the intersection of doing in this whole notion of Descartes from back when, that thought and cognition and rationality and emotion are two totally separate realms. And the hippocampus is really a pivotal point at both the capacity to pull out memories, the highly emotional ones, and have to change your behavior, and the capacity of emotion to greatly distort the way you file away memories. And it's at the intersection of that, and some of the most interesting things we do cognitively are the ones that show the extent to which we are not a rational organism in the economist sense. Hippocampus, once you get past the fact that, oh, hippocampus is good for, like, you remembering somebody's phone number, hippocampus is the intersection of how we're not this gleaming cortex of the computer and then all this emotional, hormonal yuck going on underneath and they never touch. Hippocampus is where they touch. So that's probably the part that's most interesting to me.
Okay. What is the effect of stress on the all-important
Alzheimer's
brain disease, spelled Jakob disease, etc.? Thanks.
Thanks for putting the et cetera. Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease initially looks like bad news. The part of the brain most damaged by stress and glucocorticoids is the hippocampus. The part of the brain most damaged in Alzheimer's disease is the hippocampus. Once you have Alzheimer's disease, you have elevated levels of those glucocorticoids. And this started first getting sorted out in the 80s, and that was sort of some of the work I was in on at the beginning, and we instantly wet our pants and said, oh my God, stress has to increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And a gazillion epidemiological studies later, turns out that's not where we need to worry about it. There's lots of reasons to think that a history of high-dose synthetic glucocorticoids, corticosteroids like prednisone, will increase your risk for some neurodegenerative diseases, but not Alzheimer's. So that was a ton of work going into that, and I had every professional incentive on earth to show that Alzheimer's was more at risk of chronic stress, and that one's not there. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is a truly bizarre, interesting neurological disease. It's the human equivalent of what's called mad cow disease. And it's like this whole class of neurological disorders called prion diseases that involve infectious particles that consist of stuff that no infectious particles are supposed to do in medicine. They're made of proteins instead of viral DNA. And the first version that was discovered was this disease called Kuru, which you find amongst cannibals in New Guinea, and was passed on by eating the brains of individuals after they died. And it's all very exciting. And the guy who first described this at UCSF got the Nobel Prize about 10 years ago. And it's wonderfully trendy stuff. Stress has nothing to do with it, I'm sorry to say, in terms of there's lots of funding for Graham's disease and not in my neighborhood research. But it's one where stress does not have an angle with it. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease used to be utterly mysterious in about 10% of the cases, and about 90% were due to medical contamination. Its infectious particles from Creutzfeldt-Jakob are the most resistant things to sterilization known in medicine. Most of the cases were due to neurosurgical instruments being used on somebody who later turned out to have Creutzfeldt-Jakob and moved to the next patient after perfectly normal appropriate sterilization. Or transplantations of corneas from donors to somebody where it turned out Creutzfeldt-Jakob, meninges from a cadaver to somebody else. And for a while in the 1980s, there was this whole program for treating pituitary dwarfism in kids by extracting growth hormone from the pituitaries of cadavers until about 10 kids were given Creutzfeldt-Jakob because of pituitaries from somebody who turned out to have the disease. Total nightmare, horrible stuff, 20 cases a year. What's the huge worrisome thing now is whether it's coming from the meat supply. and there's been a couple of hundred cases in Europe, predominantly in England, due to mad cow disease, and the official party line is there's no mad cow disease in cows in the United States. There have been two cases so far, but the cows were born in Canada, so we don't have to worry. England, they spent 5 to 10 years denying it was there when it was in the livestock ministry. I see no reason to think that it's not here by now. So, maybe we should convince you to be atheist, but we should become vegetarian. One for two.
This one's complicated. What did you want to be when you were in high school?
A primatologist, actually. I had all these advisees at Stanford, and somewhere in spring and senior year, they suddenly realized they're going to graduate and they don't have a major yet, and they're sort of panic. And they come in and they do me well, I don't need to figure out what I want to do, what to do. And I always make them feel much, much worse when I say, well, actually, I was paid to decide what I wanted to do. So by the time I was 12, I was writing like fan letters to primatologists. I occasionally meet these guys, all these emeritus guys, and I dimly remember these crayons, hyper intense, unmodulated sort of letters from some kid back when. I did 2 years of Swahili in high school because I knew I was going to be field working in South Africa at some point. So I think I was.
Your high school had Swahili?
Hippie high school in New York in the 1970s. I have learned no Swahili whatsoever. It was completely useless. I learned, it was a textbook used for City University in New York. So I arrived in East Africa in my early 20s knowing how to describe the New York City subway system. Yes, I decided very early on. That's what I wanted to do.
Well, I think you said in one of your books you actually wanted to be a gorilla.
actually, it was gorillas. I was much, much more taken with gorillas, mountain gorillas, but you couldn't do what I do, the research I do on gorillas, so baboons came along. I've never much liked them, but 30 years later, they've been good to me. But gorillas are the ones who really do it for me. And thus the fact that there's only 400 or 500 mountain gorillas left on Earth is not a pleasing fact.
Okay, this is our last question this evening. What will science never underlearn? Be able to explain about our behavior or the mind?
Oh good, that's the last one. Well, let me finish up with a hopefully not too painfully long soapbox preaching or something, which is, an extremely useful thing that happened in Western thought about 500-600 years ago was this notion of reductionism, which is, if you want to explain something complicated, you break it down to its component parts, and you figure out what the parts do, and you put them all back together, and you explain the big thing. And that's been extremely good for understanding why a clock stopped to run. It's not because the clock god has gotten upset with it and needs to wave some goat innards at it. It's because the clock and there's a gear that's lost the tooth. And that's been very good for figuring out why polio does what it does and how to make a vaccine. But as we get to the really interesting stuff about behavior and about health, it completely breaks down. You want to do the best possible things for helping westernized medicine, here's what you need to do. You need to figure out why is it that people stop taking their medicine, even though they're not supposed to do that, and why is it that when we're feeling unloved, we eat more? You want to cure diseases, that's do those two things, and there's no reductive science that's ever going to give you anything with that. There's no reductive science that's ever going to tell us why we love the wrong people or why we do or move by the things we do. The whole notion that now that we've got the human genome and the DNA sequences, if you want to understand things, break the interesting human brain or the human society or the human neuron or the human anything into its component parts and understand them and glue them back together, and then you're going to understand the interesting stuff. It's never ever going to work that way. So we have long passed the point where reductive, westernized scientific thinking is good to explain the interesting stuff. Reductionism is very good for explaining why clocks have stopped working. They're not good for explaining why clouds have stopped raining, and you're much more like clouds than clocks.